Greetings from BBS Radio, where truth and news still exist in the original form. You're tuned in to The Spiritual Politician, the show that shows you where politics, government, and selfishness went wrong, and how you can take action to make it right. I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster, your host for this hour of insight, aimed at making each of us more responsible, cooperative, and aware of the spiritual bonds that connect us, no matter what we find to bicker about. You can call us toll-free from the U.S. at 877-876-5227, from Canada to 888-810-8322, or you can call direct to 530-876-3222. This show is carried online, and you'll also be able to get it on the air in your local area. To find out if one of those old-fashioned on-the-air stations in your area carries this show, just contact us at bbsradio.com. The website for this show can be found on the BBS Radio site and at spiritualpolitician.blogspot.com. All past shows become available as soon as it is humanly possible on the station archives. And now our update on events from the past week. Phil Smart, the Texas CPA, who has faced harassment in Ellis County, Texas, for having the audacity to ask for copies of their general ledgers, we reported last week, had received a summons to appear in court yesterday. He made a statement after the close of those proceedings. Here's what he said. Today I appeared in Gene Calvert's court at law number 2 on 2 charges, one in possession of a dangerous drug and another civil charge of possession on a controlled substance. Some time ago, I provided evidence that these were actually my own personal prescriptions. The charges were dismissed. I had already spent 20 days in county jail. I was never charged with anything more than allegedly failing to stop at a designated point at the stop sign in Red Oak by David Rogers. I do believe, by living here for as long as I have, there's definitely no coincidence that every time I run for office, I get arrested on some phony charge. When asked if Smart would run for office in the future, he responded, "You can bet on it." Smart went to court with 7 supporters. They waited 2 hours for the 10-second hearing. Ellis County, Texas, continues to amaze us. A snippet of an update from New York. Watch for developments on the money that funds Howie Rich scams as the FEC makes available the spending from the last 2 weeks of the last campaign. Hart Williams says the whole story is bound to be interesting. Now that we're all recovering from the holidays and looking forward to a new year, the time has come to think about what kind of world we want to create. We do that, you know. The great mystery and power of humanity is that we create the world in which we live, the human world, through ideas we turn into action. Someone starts using an idea, and then others see it demonstrated and say, "Hey, that's a good idea." And in this way, it becomes a part of our collective wisdom. Cooperation itself was first an idea put into practice by some of our unknown human ancestors. Grab that fish, it's getting away. You can just see that early ancestor pointing and gesturing. We were doubtless cooperating even before we had words to discuss it. Cooperation remains the foundation of human action today, even when it seems like no one is. Cooperation and freedom. Two things some people don't think go together at all, but they really do. Freedom is our individual ability to act for ourselves, solving the problems that confront us. We do that while living in community with others. Getting along with others is a challenge sometimes, but in community we have help grabbing the fish. Living cheek and jowl with others means that we have to take responsibility for making things work. When the waters are rising, you better move out of danger's way in life, we live or die by the choices we make. Centralizing decision-making in government is sort of like letting a committee of the kids you didn't trust in kindergarten decide who you should marry. You know best for yourself, and it's you who will be living with it. Despite the presence of government, Americans continue to get out there, solve their own problems, and change their parts of the world in ways that make it better and safer for all of us. The best solutions are the ones that work. Most of those are local. Those solutions change us as we work to make things better for everyone. Practice might not make us perfect, but it does improve the score. How we make children safer in America today is one of the problems that we face. Through individual choices, we change ourselves, our communities, and the world around us. Those solutions can even be retaught, making the world better in places we never go ourselves. For every problem, there are solutions. Not just one, but many. Which one we choose makes us who we are and remakes the world in our own image. Our guest tonight faced a problem as parents, living through one of the most horrific experiences anyone can face, the abduction of their child. On April 3, 1997, Laura Kate Smither, the Smithers' only daughter, then a 12-year-old child, was abducted near her home in Friendswood, Texas. Laura was then an aspiring ballerina, certified scuba diver, cadet Girl Scout, and a gifted student. The community came together to take action. It was a frightening and bewildering time. No one knew what to do, least of all Laura's parents, Gay and Bob. The community of Friendswood established the Laura Recovery Center and launched a nationwide search to find the missing child. More than 6,000 volunteers put their own lives on hold to give their time and commitment to find Laura. Her body was discovered 17 days later. Today we're going to hear their story and about the work of the Laura Center Recovery Foundation. That's work that they have undertaken that's changing the world. Gay Smither was born in Zimbabwe. She attended Rhodes University, Grahamstown, South Africa. After graduating, she taught English at Highfield High School there, becoming the head of the English department. She traveled extensively before settling in Texas, where she married her husband, Bob, becoming a naturalized American citizen. She became corporate secretary and electronic technician for Circuit Concepts Incorporated in 1986. As a community activist, Gay served as Girl Scout leader for her daughter's troop for 7 years and as consultant with the Friendswood service team of South Texas Girl Scout Council for 10 years, and served as an active volunteer with her son's Boy Scouts of the American troop and with Armand Bayou Nature Center. She was a wildlife rehabilitator with Texas Wildlife Rehabilitation and Education, specializing in owl rehabilitation. Currently, Gay is very involved in several ministries at Good Shepherd Episcopal Church and was commissioned as a Stevens minister in 2003. Bob Smither was born in Texas. He attended the University of Houston, where he received a Ph.D. in electrical engineering. Bob incorporated Circuit Concepts Incorporated, an engineering consulting firm, in 1978. He's been president of Circuit Concepts Incorporated ever since. Dr. Smither taught electrical engineering at the University of Houston for 14 years. During that time, he supervised master and Ph.D. students. He holds 19 patents and is a member of several engineering and honor societies. Bob was active with Armand Bayou Nature Center and served on its board of directors. He was a volunteer with Boy Scouts of America while his son was a member, and founded and is active with the Gulf Coast Turtle and Tortoise Society. He was a science and math teacher for Home Education Partnership, teaching courses to homeschool students. The Smithers are both very much invested and active in their community, and they always have been. Please welcome Gay and Bob Smither. Gay, Bob, are you there?
Yes. Hi.
Hi. I'm so glad that you could be with us today to talk about the Laura Center. We always begin by asking our guests to talk a little bit about themselves. How did you two meet?
I went to work for Bob to take care of Laura, his daughter at the time. She was 2 years old, and I went to work for him to help as her nanny, as Laura's nanny.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an interesting way to meet.
It's sort of the Sound of Music brought to life.
That's right. It sounds like it. The Sound of Music.
Yeah. Laura's birth mom, my first wife, had passed away, and Gay came to rescue us and has been rescuing me ever since.
Mm-hmm. It's nice when relationships work like that, isn't it?
It is.
When you feel loved and supported and rescued. Yes. So you two, you've been married, you've been through a lot of things that most people never go through in any kind of relationship whatsoever. And I can tell, I know Laura was, you know, an incredibly special part of your lives. Just from reading your bios, you can see that, because you can see how your life's focused on your children and your family. Tell us a little bit about Laura and how her story became the foundation that you two now have started.
Well, you know, Laura was so special. I know every parent says that about their children, and of course, it's true of every child. Laura was very gifted. She participated in the gifted program at school. She had aspirations of going to Stanford, and I firmly believe that she would have made it. She had a real wide range of interest. One of the things that characterized Laura was a sense of fairness. Even as a very young child, we had her in a daycare at the University of Houston, actually, when she was real young. And the kids would come to her to resolve their disputes because they knew that she was just inherently a fair person and was interested in fairness. The manager of that program, in fact, took us aside one day and said, you know, one of these days I'm going to get married and I'll have a child, and I don't care if it's a boy or a girl, I'm going to call it Laura because she is such a special kid. And, you know, that's just something that just characterized her.
Mm-hmm. So you have a young girl here who's extremely, really everybody recognizes as very special. Is this
Absolutely.
One of the reasons you Absolutely. Think that the community came together the way it did?
You know, that's really interesting, because most of the people that came together did not know Laura. Now, certainly some of the core volunteers did, but the community response was just incredible.
But because Laura was so loved by people at school and in the activities that she did, in particular in ballet, she had been in to three different ballet schools, and so there was there were a lot of people who knew her. They may not have known her as obviously as well as we did, but she was loved by so many people. So when she first went missing, the groundswell from the community, I truly believe, happened because so many people knew her or knew somebody who knew her, and she had touched so many people with her light.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, you know, it was like a brush fire that was lit, and people came forward as a result of that.
One of the volunteers at the search center, I happened to be there one day and just walked past, a reporter was asking one of the volunteers, and they said, well, you know, why are you doing this? Why are you putting your life on hold to search for this young girl? She's not your child. And the volunteer said, well, I know Laura, and that child has never raised her voice to her mother. She's just that sort of person, and of course I'm going to be here to try to help.
Mm-hmm. So she was special in a lot of different ways. I mean, she was just sort of person everybody wishes they had as a child.
Absolutely. And she was also a regular kid who, you know, just loved life.
Mm-hmm.
Just loved life.
When did you realize she was missing? How long did that take?
Not long at all. It was within 20 minutes of the time that we expected her to come home. At the time we lived in a pretty rural area on the outskirts of our little town, surrounded by cow fields and cows. And she had gone out for a run for the first time ever, and her little brother and I were making pancakes for breakfast that morning, and she went out for a quick jog because she was all inspired to get healthy and fit, and we expected her back within 20 minutes, and when she didn't come back, we knew that something was wrong.
Mm-hmm. So you started looking immediately?
Yes. And, of course, when we didn't find her immediately, then we really knew something was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there were only one or two places where she would be. She had never run by herself before, but she had gone along on her bicycle when I would run, for example. And so she knew the routes that I took. And so I, you know, figured that she would be on one of those routes. A friend of mine happened to be here that day, and the two of us got in the car and went and looked basically at the end of our road and down two other roads, which would be the only place that she would have gone based on her accompanying me before on my runs.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we started to realize something was seriously wrong and came back to the house and called the police.
And the police came over, because they do immediately when it's a child, right?
They did. They were very good. Within just a few minutes, they were taking a report. And within not much longer after that, Gay and I and my friend, went back out searching, of course.
And David,
our son, as soon as the report was taken, and then... But the police were out there very quickly as well, along with some neighbors. I went over to a neighbor's house where some folks were out tending their horses and asked if they'd seen Laura. And, of course, no, they hadn't, but they knew her. And I think some calls were made from that encounter that brought other people out. So really within an hour or so, there were quite a few people combing the neighborhood looking for her,
mm-hmm.
including the police.
And then what happened? You didn't find her. But the community did come together and actually start trying to organize the search, right?
Right. In fact, sometime in the afternoon, the local media heard that a child was missing in Friendswood, and the news media were at right here in our home and in the area by 5 o'clock that afternoon, I'd say, maybe a little before that. And so it hit the evening hour news, and people just began pouring in at that point. I mean, we had a number of friends and family who had been helping us through the day, but it really went into, you know, very large numbers from those first news reports.
Mm-hmm.
Later on the same day that she was missing.
Was this out of your home then?
Yes, at the beginning. And then the community kind of started to organize themselves. We were searching from our house, and the community started organizing. There was there's a ball field close by, and the first gatherings actually happened at the ball field.
Yeah, she went missing on a Thursday, and Friday morning the police, I don't know how that communication took place, because of course we had been frantically searching all night, but the police and citizens gathered at a ball field close to the house, and the police, you know, lined up the volunteers, and they marched through some rather thick brush and so forth in the area and combed that, and they spent a good part of the day covering some wooded areas close to our house.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of Friday, I went down to the police station to, you know, see what they had done and what their future plans were, because we were certainly running out of ideas. We had been distributing flyers from our little copier here at the house all day through volunteers that came. And they said, well, you know, basically the police were finished with their searching because they hadn't found her, and would, you know, it would from that point on be basically an investigation. Sort of unbeknownst to us really at this time, that was Friday. I believe by Saturday, a group of local volunteers had gotten themselves organized at the Chamber of Commerce and were starting to, you know, figure out what they could do, working with the police, what they could do to continue searching, since the police basically had, you know, determined at that point that they were kind of in an investigative mode. That very quickly outgrew the chamber, and
let me interrupt
sure.
you, Bob. That initial core group spoke to the police and said, well, we haven't found her, we can't stop searching, and the police had said that they were going to stop physically searching and just turn to investigation. And it was with the blessings of our police chief who said, if the community wants to continue searching, that's great. And that's when they sort of turned the search operations over to the community, you know, with their blessings.
Mm-hmm.
And they worked throughout the course of the search very closely, you know, the community turning over all leads that came in and everything to the police. But it was certainly with the blessings of the investigative division.
I think our police realized that, you know, I mean, they just don't have the manpower to do a large-scale search, so they were quite happy to have the community do that. Like I say, that effort quickly outgrew the chamber, and they took over a building that was only being partially used by a local power company, and that's where the search was headquartered for the rest of the time.
Mm-hmm. And so you'd never been involved in a search before.
Absolutely not.
Has anybody in the neighborhood, in the community, been involved?
Not really.
No, in fact, we learned much, much later that a lot of young girls and young women had been reported missing, but there had never been any significant searching done for any of them.
Oh.
And we certainly were totally unaware, as was everybody else in the area, that there was even a problem. And it was the huge reaction to Laura being missing that brought all those other cases to light.
So this had been going on, and children had, and young women had been disappearing, and nobody knew it.
Right. There was really very little awareness, that there were any missing children or missing persons in our area, up until Laura's disappearance.
Yeah, typically there'd be, you know, a small amount of coverage about a missing child, but like one news story or something, and then you'd never hear anything more about it, because basically there was no continuing searching. There was no high-profile searching being done for these missing children.
Of course, the families were searching, but they were really on their own.
Exactly.
Which was what made our situation and what made us so incredibly fortunate in the worst time of our life,
mm-hmm.
was that our community wrapped their arms around us and came forward in, you know, multitudes,
mm-hmm.
to help us search. And so many other families weren't blessed with what we were blessed with.
But the question that you had about just the experience of people, really, they just made it up as they went. The core group of volunteers here in Friendswood certainly had never been faced with anything like this. After about day three or four, they contacted the Heidi Search Center in San Antonio, and the director there came and to help organize the community-based search here.
Mm-hmm. And that was very helpful?
It was. In fact, after all the dust settled, we remained in contact with Mr. Walcott, who was Heidi's executive director at the time. And when we decided to start the Laura Recovery Center as an ongoing effort, after a couple of years, it was about 2 years later, we were still in contact with Bob, and turned out to be mutually agreeable that he is now our executive director. I won't say we stole him from Heidi. It was just, you know, it was
a good fit.
It was a good time for him and a good time for us. So he is in fact now our executive director. But he was the first person, and he didn't get here until like the late Saturday or Sunday of after she went missing on a Thursday, to help organize the search. So the volunteers,
who had any experience.
He was the only one that had any experience in this. So the volunteers were really on their own, and it is, in hindsight, it is remarkable what they did.
So the community came together and they started a radical learning curve, it sounds like.
Exactly.
About how to do this and how to make it happen. What things did you find out that about doing a search?
We personally didn't find out an awful lot during the time because, of course, we were so we were being briefed by the police every day. We were doing our own frantic kind of random searching. We got, because of the high publicity, we had phone calls with psychics, and we would, you know, run out and follow those leads foolishly. So we personally didn't learn a lot, but the volunteers learned an awful lot. Toward the end of the actual search, actually, I'd say maybe midway through it or so, Gay and I became more directly involved with the efforts of the community, because the police, you know, that effort had sort of tailed back a little bit, understandably, so we weren't required to interact with them every day. And
we weren't under, you know, the first week or so, we were under direct scrutiny, as any parent or guardian of a child is when a child goes missing, and that's appropriate. And so, you know, that was one of the reasons that kept us separate, was that we were being investigated ourselves by the police and every other branch of law enforcement that interrogated us.
Yes.
Yeah, but the volunteers were learning very quickly, and toward the latter half of the effort, they very kindly put Gay and I to work. We would just go around and talk to people at the various stations and just discuss what they were doing and take notes. And those notes became the first part of documenting what happened and creating a manual for other communities to use so they don't have to reinvent this every time a child goes missing.
And that's one of the things that you've done with the foundation that's been tremendously valuable to people all over the country.
Yeah, we had probably two main motivators. After Laura was found, of course, Gay and I were destroyed, but the core volunteers, I think now we know that they were doing a critical incident stress debriefing without actually calling it that. They
were compelled to come together,
right.
Having gone through this devastating experience. Once Laura was found, and you know they had spent 17 days and nights working side by side, and obviously became very close to the people who were in the middle of the fire.
Mm-hmm.
And they just had to get together, and that's exactly what they did. They came together just to be together, to comfort one another, because of the outcome.
But they used, I guess, as a reason for meeting, they wanted to document what was done, and they wanted to provide a resource for other communities. So starting basically with the notes that Gay and I had taken, which I honestly don't know if they were coherent or not,
mm-hmm.
but you know, in their meetings, I think we figured at one point they met more than 2,000 hours in meetings during that first year. They would meet 2-3 times a week, and then slowly a little less. But they were doing storyboards and taking very comprehensive notes and outlines of what worked and what didn't work and how you organize a search like this and what resources you need and so forth.
And they not only met with one another, but I remember them calling in some of the news media and sort of interviewing them about their experience, so that the media piece was covered as well, not just from the community's point of view, but from the media's point of view.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it was a pretty thorough look at everything that happened.
The news coverage was quite exceptional, very professional and very compassionate, and they really wanted to find out from the media itself, you know, why that happened. But anyway, as a result of all this, the volunteers put together the notes for a comprehensive search manual. The other thing that happened after Laura was found was the volunteers and even Gay and I received phone calls from other families with missing children.
Mm-hmm.
So those two things, the manual and these ongoing phone calls, in fact, on August the 17th, the neighbor of a girl who lived in Tiki Island was on our doorstep asking for help because the girl had not come home the night before. In fact, she is still missing. She was, you know, and we went down and I really mean the Corps volunteers at that time, went down and organized a search for Jessica.
Mm-hmm.
So that coupled, the manual, the availability of the manual coupled with these ongoing cries for help told us that there was something that needed doing and that maybe we could actually make a difference in this area. So that's what led us to start the foundation, to formalize it. Yeah.
So what happened is you came, the Corps volunteers and you came together and put together a manual that actually integrated the police, the community, you know, what things needed to happen first and, you know, what protocols to follow, and then what the media should do as well.
Exactly.
In fact, we've, out of those very early meetings following Laura being found, it was actually our police chief, one of the volunteers said, "Chief, what do you think actually happened?" And he put his fingers together, forming a triangle, you know, the thumb and the first finger together, and he said, "Well, it was really law enforcement, the family, and the community all coming together to surround the search for Laura, and from that we coined the term the triangle of trust,
mm-hmm.
Where law enforcement, community, and family come together to search for a missing child. Your very best." Scenario is presented with all those components working together.
Mm-hmm. So you need to absolutely have the cooperation. But one of the other things that you found out was, of course, other children had been missing and you didn't know it. So was one of the things that you put together as part of the manual, the fact that communities needed to be aware and know when these things were going on?
We certainly have a piece in there about how to notify communities, you know, through news media, through flyers, and this, that, and the other. I do think the situation has changed since Laura went missing. I think that the whole issue of missing children has gained much more state and regional and national attention.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a good thing. You know, parents need to be aware of the dangers that are out there. The direct answer to your question, though, the manual really addresses a specific search for a specific child.
Mm-hmm.
And it does talk about publicity, for that one case, so to speak. In other words, you know, how you can engage the media, how you can notify the community. The broader aspects Gay and I have worked on as volunteers, as the opportunity presents itself, you know, just to make people aware of this.
Mm-hmm.
We've worked with early on, we worked with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. They had a program called Know the Rules, which, in fact, used Laura's case as one example. And we worked with them and helped publicize that and, you know, went out to billboard openings and things like that just to raise the public awareness of this whole issue.
And the manual that you put together is actually available on your website and can be downloaded.
Absolutely.
So nobody needs to have a moment's doubt. They can get it. They can get it and read it now.
Right. If they can either just look at it page by page and, you know, browse it as in HTML, page at a time. It's all linked together and from a table of contents, or they can download a PDF and print it out. It's pushing about 100 pages, so it's a little bit of a commitment to print it out, but
mm-hmm.
people can certainly look at it and, you know, get a flavor for the sort of very useful information that's in there.
And of course, anyone who requests that, in particular, law enforcement agencies that request copies of the manual, we mail those out to law enforcement agencies.
And mm-hmm. and we've FedExed them overnight, both to law enforcement
and
to families.
Families.
One thing that I think is, and I'm proud of, that's unique, I think, about the Law Recovery Center is we will respond when. We respond under several conditions. Among them are we believe the child was abducted. When I say respond, I mean go out and sort of organize a search.
Mm-hmm.
We believe the child was abducted, and we're asked to do so by law enforcement or the family. There are times when law enforcement has a different opinion about a situation than we might, and so, you know, we will respond just at the request of the family if we think the situation warrants it.
Mm-hmm. And if not, we would, you know, we will respond in other types of case management work, but not specifically a ground search.
Right. We simply don't have the resources, for example, to search for runaways.
Mm-hmm.
But we will always work with a family in terms of producing flyers for them and any other sort of assistance we can do. If we become convinced that a child is abducted, then, you know, we'll do the maximum that we can.
Mm-hmm. And on your site, you actually have a template for producing the flyer that takes the user through and gives them all the information that they need to include on the flyer, so they don't need to know in advance or even think about it. They can just fill it in.
Right. That's actually the same template that we use, but we make a public version available. Anybody can go to our website and create a missing person flyer. And
people do every day.
Yeah, we get several a week. Maybe just about every day somebody creates a flyer using our flyer creation tool, and you know that makes us feel good that we're able to provide that service. Very often it's law enforcement. They'll produce a flyer. The tool, once it's used, gives you the option of downloading a PDF. So once you've made your flyer, you can download it, print it out, or law enforcement can download it and print it out and use it in the local community.
Mm-hmm. And you've actually been. Part of your outreach has been to law enforcement, and you've done trainings for law enforcement.
We have. We've had the opportunity to train several law enforcement agencies in our immediate area, including the Houston Police Department. I think I heard they're like the fourth largest department in the country. And we've trained, gosh, a substantial percentage, probably almost all, probably most of the duty officers,
and that's an ongoing thing. In fact, we have a cadet class on the 18th of this month, and we did have a grant that allowed us to travel around the state of Texas for 2 years, taking our program to other law enforcement agencies around Texas to train them as well.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that's very much appreciated.
We get very good feedback from the officers. We have a questionnaire that we ask them to fill out at the end. And, you know, some of the questions we ask, is this information old hat? Was this useful? Should this be taught by law enforcement? Things like that. And we get very, very good feedback from that questionnaire. One of the things that we do at that training, that Gay does is present a victim's perspective. She talks to the officers about what it was like for our family when Laura was missing. And a lot of the feedback centers on her presentation and how powerful it is. And you know, we are accomplishing something, because very often we get feedback from these hardened police officers, and I know their job is incredibly tough, but we get feedback, you know, that says, I will never look at a missing child case the same way again. So we do think we're having an impact.
Mm-hmm. What's really important is, you know, there are all these programs on television, CSI and Missing Without a Trace, and these programs are so far-fetched. But what it does is it creates this illusion in the public's minds that if their child goes missing, they're going to have all these amazing non-existent technologies that are, you know, going to be brought to bear on their missing child. And then when it happens, of course, they discover very quickly that it's not like television at all.
Mm-hmm.
Missing children are, certainly if they're very young, they get a lot of attention, but there are hundreds of thousands of children who go missing under all sorts of circumstances who receive absolutely no attention and very often absolutely no response from law enforcement whatsoever.
Now, why is that?
And so the purpose of our training is to really sensitize the police to what is the community's expectation of you?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and then use our experience to present what we think they should be doing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, try and bridge that gap between the distortion of Hollywood and what actually happens.
You've had a lot of contact with parents who've, you know, come to you and asked for help. What have their stories been like? Have you dealt with people who have just simply not been able to get a response from law enforcement?
Oh, more than we would like.
Yeah.
Many cases are like that.
And that's what I say that I think somewhat sets us apart is that, if in talking to the family we become convinced that you know something is really wrong and the police have somehow missed it, we will do what we can to help that family. There was a boy in California a year or so ago that we spoke with the family, and over the course of several days we spoke with him. He'd actually been missing for a while before they called us. The police had tagged him as a runaway and had, you know, not really done much about it. But in talking to the family, we decided that there was more to it than that, and we went out and organized a search. The community was desperate to search. They just needed a little bit of guidance.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, again, they just didn't buy the runaway tag on this boy, the people that actually knew him. And sure enough, he had been murdered. One of our search teams found him. I'm convinced that without our efforts, you know, his killer would be walking around today. And
that's
he's not. He's in jail. Pardon?
That's another frightening aspect, because oftentimes these people repeat the behavior.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And for instance, in your daughter's case, the person that you believe actually abducted your daughter was responsible for another abduction, at least one.
Oh, at least two that he had actually been tried and convicted on. In fact, he had been in jail, and a judge let him out of jail 5 years early, and within 6 months he had killed Laura.
Mm-hmm.
But that was his second jail term and conviction on abductions and rapes.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
There
are many, many sexual predators who have harmed so many children before they caught the first time. And it just continues to appall us that our judicial system lets us down as civilians by letting the predators out every day.
Mm-hmm.
And you understand the distinction that needs to be drawn between sexual offenders and sexual predators, because there's a very, very wide range of behavior. But certainly the ones that would be categorized as predators, the ones who patrol the streets looking for children to abduct and harm, those are the ones who, when they're caught the first time, our judicial system should never let them go to have the opportunity to harm another child.
Mm-hmm. Because it's not a behavior that ever changes.
Exactly. And that's been proved by the recidivism rate.
Mm-hmm.
And that certainly seems to be the case. We are encouraged by some of the changes in the laws. Jessica Lunsford, who actually went out and organized a search for, was a 10-year-old girl in Florida that was taken and killed by a repeat offender. Her dad is an amazing person and has gone across the country pushing for what he calls Jessica's Law. The gist of it is that these worst type offenders need to be sentenced for a minimum of 25 years. And if they ever are released, that they need to be monitored for the rest of their lives with some sort of GPS anklet mm-hmm. or ankle thing. And that's certainly a step in the right direction. You know, like Gay just said, when an adult seriously harms a child, they just should never have the opportunity to do it again. And I think Jessica's Law is a big step in that direction.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. When you've had the outreach to law enforcement, is this a subject that you bring up and you discuss about how the law should change, how protocols should change in this regard?
We're a little careful about it because we are a 501c3, so we have to be a little careful about legislation and so forth. Yeah. But as individuals, we mention it to anybody that'll listen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're certainly outside of the training talk to police and talk to the community at large about the awareness on legislation, but we do it as private individuals, not as the Laurel Recovery Center.
And by and large, the police are on board. I mean, their job has to be infinitely frustrating because they work hard to bring some of these people to justice. And then the system lets them back out again.
Mm-hmm.
How frustrating that must be, not only, I know it's frustrating for the families, but how frustrating it must be for the law enforcement officers that really worked the case, did the right thing, got these guys put away, and then like in the case of Laura's killer, the system lets them out 5 years early.
Mm-hmm. So it isn't
that,
really
that revolving door when it's so hard for the police, to put cases together because, you know, it's not as easy as it looks on television. And putting that case together and just getting a search warrant, the probable cause and the things that are required just to get a search warrant, in these cases is so difficult. And so when a conviction actually happens, on a heinous abductor, to then that revolving door to put the perpetrator back out on the streets after all that work has been done, and for them to have that opportunity to harm another child is just, it's unconscionable. It's unconscionable that we as a society accept that.
Mm-hmm.
That we don't do, that's where I feel our judicial system lets us down. It does not, take the steps to keep them away.
Mm-hmm. So that's something that needs to change about our court system, you think? That would be law enforcement.
I think that if juries normally do the right thing, and it's the criminal justice system after the fact, through the appeals process and the endless reviews that go on, and I think there are so many wonderful things about our court system that it seems to me that it favors the criminal and forgets the victim.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Gay really had a significant comment there that often juries who are allowed to hear the full evidence, which of course sometimes doesn't happen also, they often do the right thing. They had put Laura's killer away, like I say, for a significant number of years. And yet a judge was able to override the jury's decision and let him out early.
Why did the judge do that?
There was, I honestly don't know, some technicality was what I heard. But, you know, this just happens all the time. And we've had, in Texas, fortunately it's no longer the law, I don't think, but we had a...
mandatory release.
Yeah, a program called mandatory release, where if you behave well, they take time off your sentence. And that's not what the jury intended. So there are a lot of changes, I think, that need to be made in the judicial system. Again, though, juries have to have the tools to put these guys away, and I'm very encouraged by the work that Mr. Lunsford's doing on Jessica's Law.
Has anybody actually prepared information to give to jurors? I know that fully informed jury, you know, that group gives information on the rights of jurors.
You know, not that I'm aware of. That would be an interesting case to put together information about sexual predators and try to present it to the jury pool. I don't know how far you would get with that or not in our current system, but it certainly is an interesting idea.
Well, you might not need to wait until you have a jury about to be impaneled. You could actually simply disseminate it in the general public.
I think that's an excellent idea. I'm not aware of anybody that's doing that. I mean, other than just the general knowledge that, like I mentioned before, I think has improved a lot over the years, just the general awareness of this problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that Jessica's Law is a reflection of that. It shows a willingness of legislatures finally to start to do the right thing, to make these sentences long enough that they're worth something, and then to monitor these guys after, if they're ever released.
Amen. Now, what can parents do to keep their children safe? If you were going to give parents, you know, a short list of rules to keep the kids safe, what would you tell them?
Never go out alone. Always ask permission from the parent or guardian or the adult who's supervising the child. To go anywhere and to not go alone. I mean,
mm-hmm.
those are the two critical rules.
The unfortunate truth in our society today is that parents need to keep their eyes on their kids at all times. It's like the kids are under lock and key because of these predators, rather than because they're not under lock and key. So unfortunately, it through a certain age group, it almost requires continuous monitoring. But certainly what Gay said about never go out alone, always make sure people know where you are, make sure people know when to expect you back. That can go a long way.
And along with that, always children also need to learn to verify information that one of the lures that is used by children is used by family members. Over 300,000 children are abducted by a family member, and those cases, the child, if they had known maybe to verify with the custodial parent, my dad or my aunt or uncle or whoever it is who becomes the abductor, that the children ask permission of the custodial parent or the custodial guardian, so that that's an additional safeguard.
That's horrifying,
to prevent family abductions, because there's so many of them.
You would ask what parents can do. What what we try to do with one of our training programs is to teach kids what to do and what to be aware of. There are any number of lures that these predators use to get our kids out of a safe area. And so we try to make the kids aware of some of the more common lures. The classic one is, gee, my puppy is lost. You know, I'll give you $5 if you help me look for him, stuff like that.
Yeah.
And so we try to make the kids aware of that through a program that we call SCATE. So that's one of the things that kids themselves can be empowered to remain at least safer, if not safe.
Well, if people want to get to your site, could you give people the URL? Because we're just about out of time.
It's real easy. Our official name is the Laura Recovery Center Foundation, and the initials are LRCF, Laura Recovery Center Foundation. So it's lrcf.org.
Thank you so much to both of you for being here tonight and sharing this with us. And I know that you've helped a lot of people keep their kids safe. And I hope that people get in touch with you and get active in the foundation.
Well, thank you, Melinda. We appreciate it.
Thank you. And God bless. You have a good weekend.
You too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye. And that's our show for today, Friday, January 5th, 2007. Here at The Spiritual Politician, we're working to help individuals find ways to make themselves safe and bring themselves into alignment with the way we know we really should be treating others. On this show, as we do with all our shows, we end by reading the section of the Declaration of Independence that's America's mission statement. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. They are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that the securities rights governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that when any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundations on such principles, and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evidences a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. This is Melinda Pillsbury Foster coming to you from BBS Radio. God bless the journey that brings us to freedom, and may God be with you every step of the way. Good night.